This is Geek Speak, episode 42 of season 16. I'm Lyle Troxell, and with me in the studio is Miles Elam, a software engineer, pedant, curmudgeon, and political junkie. Hey, Miles.
Hey, how's it going?
I'm doing well, sir. Well, we've got a list of bits to talk about today, and I thought we could first talk about how artificial intelligence is just going to do everything better than us.
Yes. Well, for one, they're already starting to do better than we can at playing Doom, the original classic.
When you say it plays better than us at Doom, are you saying, like, how complicated an artificial intelligence task is it to play Doom?
Right. You would think not a big deal. You hook it up to its inputs. It figures out what to do. Not a big deal. The folks at Carnegie Mellon University did not do that. Not a typical bot. What they did was they set up a webcam to look at the screen. So they're getting the exact same input that human beings are. And it learned how to play the game, and then in a tournament beat several human players.
Okay, so its control is the input of the keyboard, like our control, and its input is the screen, like our input. Did it also use audio? Do you know? Because it has stereoscopic sound, right?
I don't know if it did, but did it have stereoscopic? I think it did.
I think it did. I don't know how much it would help you. It might help a little bit. But
you had a lot more. I remember a lot more feedback looking at Duke, which way his head turned.
I want to know in Doom what it would be like to play against them. Is there any video of it playing? Does it move sporadically and do things that humans wouldn't be able to achieve as much? Like, I can imagine that when you and I are running around, we want to shoot, we stop our pivoting to shoot. But it might be that it decides to spin, shoot, move, spin, shoot, all at the same time in fluid motions. Things we just couldn't achieve.
There is no video that I see. There is the paper that was written, but that's about it.
Well, what do you think? Does that show that computer programs could maybe even program at some point? Like we argued last week? Or I argued against
Well, at the same time, this is something that is new, the fact that you were able to just point a webcam at it and have the computer figure out what's going on from the visual data. If they're not perceiving it the same way we are, if the result is the same, does it matter?
Couldn't just take an algorithm or take a computer program and have it give video signals in with different XYs out. You'd have to give it a target goal of a negative on maybe the lose screen. Like however much the lose screen comes on, you go, oh, whenever you see this, you know, that's not your goal. Your goal is to get away from that.
Mm-hmm.
And if that's the only input, that's kind of amazing. The question I have was, were they running this at real time? Because to train it might take years to train it, right?
It did take a while to train, but I'm assuming anyway. But at the same time, and this is, you know, a 1993 game, so the graphics are reasonably uniform. I'd say they're not quite as nuanced as you might find them today. It played deathmatch. It was able to play and in real time playing against another player. So it wasn't just playing the single player game and doing it, you know, compared to it. It actually was a deathmatch against human players.
I think that's great. So they're using the screen buffer. So effectively they're just using the data that's in the screen.
Were they?
Yeah. But that's fine. It's comparable. So what it means is the program learns.
Okay, yeah. Okay. For some reason, I thought they'd gone one step further, but okay.
Well, but to my mind, that's irrelevant, right? Whether you're looking at the bitmap in the screen buffer or looking at a camera picking up the bitmap that's being displayed on the screen, the only problem that would emerge was more artifacts could emerge inside that.
Although, I wonder if it would have been helpful, or if they put in a handicap that would have been useful to limit limit the perception of the reaction by 80 milliseconds or so.
The screen to render? The CRT, you mean?
No. Because that's the amount of time it takes for visual stimulus to hit, come into the human eye and then have us actually respond.
Yeah, but that's a flaw of us. That's not a flaw that the machine has to indulge in. Why? I mean, just because it takes us a while to process. Or I see, if it has access to the screen buffer, it has direct memory access to the image, and we have an 80-second buffer before we get a direct. I can see the correlation there. Maybe. Is that what you're kind of trying to say?
Yeah, kind of.
Okay. Yeah, maybe.
If you take away that 80 milliseconds and it's able to respond, it will appear to respond before we, like, we will be shot before we realize that they have pulled the trigger. Like, I don't know how to really explain that.
Yeah, yeah.
But
the other thing is, if you're using, if you have the program running in the screen buffer, if you're doing training sessions on it, you could run it at not real time. You could run it much faster, which would be nice. Because, of course, Doom can be run on an emulator, and you can just artificially produce the clock faster and run the entire thing, you know, 600 games in a few minutes if you wanted to. And that would allow the system to train faster than real time, which might take too long.
Mm-hmm.
Additionally, it took a month to write the program to play the game. So obviously there is human intelligence in there as well as artificial intelligence. Do you know what I mean?
Like, yeah.
As well as machine learning.
Human experience, anyway.
Yeah, but also human... like, there might be a rule of when you come into a room, go from left to right to pan the room, right? That might be a rule that they decided to put in place and then maybe put parameters on that later. So it's not like they just said, here are your ends, here's your screen, don't see this screen, go, right? Because
right.
You want to, that would be a lot of learning to get to that point. Not impossible, but a lot of learning. The creators have already confirmed that they will be moving on to Quake, which of course has a much richer set.
Yeah, that is full 3D rather than 2.5D. So
that's
Doom,
right.
You couldn't go underneath something else.
Right.
Because it was always on the same level. Even if you looked up and it looked like it was a balcony, that was actually still, from top down, a flat map.
Yeah. The other thing that they mention is that one of the reasons they really got good is they decided to teach the AI how to duck. And so when you're playing it, it's like collapsing down, which can be really frustrating when you're playing against a player that's much better than you.
Well, did you ever play Counter-Strike?
Yeah, of course.
Yeah. Do you remember the jump and then go prone? So it looks like people are like going a
like
Superman.
Yeah.
Maneuver going along because they made a smaller target, harder target
right,
to hit.
Right, right.
So annoying.
Well, I've wanted to, for quite a while, Miles, stay away from the topic of VI and Emacs after our 45-minute discussion on such 2 episodes ago, but it sounds like you've got more Emacs news for us.
Yes. There is now what is being called SpaceMax. It's a community-driven Emacs distribution, according to the website. And their tagline is, the best editor is neither Emacs nor Vim. It is Emacs and Vim.
What do they call it?
SpaceMax.
SpaceMax.
Which is basically they have a VI mode inside of Emacs. And which then leads to my whole tirade about Emacs is a great operating system that also happens to have an editor in it. VI just happens to be another program that runs within the Emacs operating system.
SpaceMax.org has all of the design aspects of a contemporary tool set, you know. Yeah, it's great. Looks like they've done a lot of work on this.
Oh, it's great.
I don't think this is a joke.
Oh, it's not a joke. No, they
totally thought it was a joke.
No, 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 no. This is an actual working product.
Why would you want this? If you are
exactly
this is
like you have to choose between Clinton and Trump. You have people who are very strong about either one, and they're like, no, you know what? They should be co-presidents.
What? I don't want to...
Yes, I'm going on record saying this is a supremely bad idea.
I
think that all of the developers there have done an amazing job. They are really dedicated, and they have something that is giving them focus in their lives. That's great. I think it's a horrible idea.
Hey, a couple weeks ago, we mentioned that Samsung had to recall a whole bunch of its Galaxy Note 7 because of a small flaw, and there's more news about that.
Yeah, small flaw meaning that they exploded, caught on fire... Maimed people, yes.
Small flaw. So they did a recall, and they said, bring your phones in, we'll replace them and make them all shiny.
Yes, we'll give them the new battery because the batteries that we had weren't working correctly.
Yeah, and basically they kind of assumed that was the case because there was multiple battery vendors, and only one of those battery vendors seemed to be doing the problem.
Which
so
was
they were
Samsung built-in one. The ones they were getting from China. People were saying, like, oh, those cheap Chinese batteries. The cheap Chinese batteries were doing just fine.
Oh, really?
It was the Samsung batteries... with their source, their own internal sourcing that was
that had their
problem.
Label on it,
mm-hmm. And well, they did the swap out. They gave people these new updated batteries, new updated tech, and presumably it was going to be okay. Except that they have been continuing to catch fire, including one that caught fire on a Southwest airline plane. Luckily, it was still on the tarmac, and everyone was able to evacuate, and there were no injuries. There is another individual who his phone caught fire. It wasn't even plugged in. It wasn't like it was charging at the time, which is one of the things that people were worried about, that Samsung was saying, don't plug it in, leave it charging, because once it gets fully charged, it could explode. But this one, it wasn't charging. It was sitting by his bedside, 4 a.m. It catches fire. He's awakened by the smell of smoke and fire in his bedroom, and had to be treated for smoke inhalation, and is understandably upset by it.
So this one was specifically was in his bedroom.
Yes.
So two
instances. It was a replacement phone.
So
as well.
Two instances, just like the Southwest.
It's not just two instances. I believe there are up to seven now. But yeah.
Okay. So basically, if you have the Note 7, no, don't use it. Right.
Even right.
If,
don't matter what you're doing. Don't buy it. Samsung is looking at actually doing just a full recall. They have stopped production of them.
Yeah. Well, I mean, the other thing that was happening is after the Southwest incident, the airline was just basically in the waiting room of the. Where you'd get on the plane,
mm-hmm.
in that area, people were they were announcing, if you're coming onto the plane, turn off your Samsung. If you have a Note 7, turn it off now. Do not power it on the plane at all. And that was happening to everybody in the airport multiple times, right? I'm talking about bad publicity. This is like the worst kind of publicity you could possibly have.
Yep.
Additionally, not to mention that Note 7, Galaxy Note and 7, the 7 is not going to be memorable. The Galaxy Note is going to be memorable. So in 6 years from now, people are like, oh, you have one of those phones that blows up.
Except
like, it's going to kill the
brand. There's also a Galaxy S7 and a Galaxy Edge.
Yeah, but all of... Don't you think
Edge 7?
Gonna...
And people have been freaking out about those as well.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, and that's the thing is, I think that this kind of technical scare doesn't translate to direct knowledge. It transferred to the feeling of it. And that is not a logical thing that you can fight against. Basically, the term Galaxy for a phone... It's going to have to go away.
Yeah, except this is not just an Android phone from Samsung issue. The exploding part, the catching fire so far is, but iPhone 6s have not been exempt from this as well. There's a class action lawsuit being filed for what's being called touch disease, when the screen just stops being responsive. And of course, when the touch screen on your smartphone stops being responsive, it's not really useful as a smartphone, as anyone who's ever dropped their phone and had the screen crack and it doesn't detect anymore. Yeah. And people have been giving their phone back to Apple to be replaced or have it be fixed. And Apple has worked on it. They've given it back. It hasn't worked. They take it back. And Apple goes, we're going to give you a new phone, but it's actually a refurbished phone.
That has that problem.
And the same problem will show up days or weeks later.
Okay. So there's a flaw in Apple's phones. Is this the 7 or is this the 6?
6 Plus.
The 6 Plus. Okay. So the large... And is it, you think it's the 6
Plus? Yeah, and
6
apparently,
S plus,
and apparently it's thousands of 6 Pluses.
Interesting. That's the phone I've got on me right now. I took my 6S Plus and had it. I'm having it repaired. So I had to leave it at the Apple store today, which kind of sucked. I had a reservation. It took me 20 minutes for them to finally... Like, I came on time for the reservation. It took 20 minutes of waiting for them to finally come up to me. I had everything ready to go. I was backed up, all that stuff. And now, of course, the reason I'm replacing the screen is because I broke the screen. Completely my fault. I dropped it on pavement. In any case, after that 20-minute wait, they tell me, okay, no problem. We figure all out. They take the phone and they say, okay, it'll be about an hour and a half before this is repaired. I'm like, well, I'm not waiting here for an hour and a half because I have to go do Geek Speak. I didn't tell them that. So I said, I'll come back tomorrow, you know, whatever. Mm-hmm. But it is a little scary that you're unlocking your phone, kind of leaving with them. And I actually have a backup, which is a 6 Plus. And my phone does not have that. I used it for a year. My phone doesn't have that problem. So it's not a regular problem.
They are saying that it may have something to do with Bendgate, in that there's some
some
of reinforcement. So whenever there's some flex being put onto it, that it may be causing a split between the IC controller chip and the logic board.
Okay, that kind of makes sense. So it's damaged, physical damage to the phone is kind of helping this along.
Or, yeah.
That makes sense. Well, that's a bummer. And so there's a lawsuit about this, which means that Apple's not really resolving the problem.
Not as yet.
Interesting. Of course, it's a two-year-old phone now, so you would think that they would have fixed it a while ago. It's frustrating. Also, the 6 pluses, the 6S
pluses. Or they're just hoping that people will get by the new 7.
That larger one's right up there at around $1,000. They're expensive.
Oh, yeah.
Well, I hope that they
$1,000 for the higher memory one there.
Right. Hey, in kind of fun space news, this week we had a wonderful success for Blue Origin, and they did something completely different than we've seen before.
Quick, what's Blue Origin?
Blue Origin is the other space company that's headed up by Jeff Bezos, and which is the founder of Amazon, has lots of money from that. And Jeff Bezos' plan with Blue Origin is to actually do to charge people money to go into space. And this is basically a 45-minute flight into low orbit. But you are an astronaut after that. If you fly from the U.S. into space, you become an astronaut. So rich people can spend lots of money to become an astronaut, which is really
what used to require skill, not just requires cold, hard cash. Money.
But the only way for this to occur is to make sure that no one dies, because spacecraft are dangerous. So
it's not rocket science.
What they've been working on is a way of making sure that they can abort in flight and save the occupants. So what they did on Wednesday was a targeted mid-flight abort. I mean, the thing with rocket fuel and rocket engines and rockets in general is that you have to put a whole bunch of a very oxygenated-rich fuel. And the amount of mass of that stuff is immense to get something large into space. So you have all of this fuel, you stick it in a cylinder, and you light it off. And then when that fuel is burnt out, you're really, really high up in the air, up in space, and you detach from it, and all is good. But the problem is that having that much propellant is really unstable. See many, many space accidents. And so the general concept here is, well, let's do this. Let's be able to push the people that are on top of the rocket, all this explosive, away from it fast enough such that if it explodes, the people will be fine. And so that's what they did. They didn't have people in it. It's just a trial run. They basically packed enough explosive, you know, thrust, if you will, into the capsule part that it was able to detach and get away from the large body that potentially might fail. Does that make sense?
Yep.
And they succeeded.
And they have pictures.
And they succeeded. Video. Yeah, it's pictures and video. And they succeeded so well that they thought it's actually that the engine itself would be destroyed by the propellant of the capsule. But it didn't get destroyed. In fact, they were able to land it perfectly. So they're not going to fly it again. Both those things kind of go to museums at this point because that's really cool that we're able to do that. But this means that even with like a catastrophic on the launch pod, because on the launch pad, it's extremely dangerous to be sitting up on top of all that fuel. Mm-hmm. But even at that point, they could once the spacecraft is occupied, they could eject it from that point, and the whole system could explode, and the people could potentially be totally safe, which is kind of cool. A lot of G's, though.
On the launch pad, it would be more of an issue, I would think, because there's no forward velocity, and also when there's an explosion in the main body, if you separate, that's going to suddenly cause a lot more drag on that lower portion, and it can fall away from you. If you're on the launch pad, you have to do a positive thrust to get from the...
This thing's designed for a positive thrust. It's exactly designed for that. It can
accelerate... For the launch pad.
Yeah, it can accelerate away from the launch pad. Now, of course, you still have to have a few milliseconds to know what the heck's going to happen. Something has to trigger the system to successfully detach, right? And I could imagine
And sound is slow. Yeah. Compared to an explosion.
No, this is not going to be something that's human-controlled. It's going to be sensor-controlled, right? You're going to have a whole bunch of sensors, and they're going to say, catastrophic event, detach. And it'll be automatic completely. Really cool idea. So the other thing is that this craft that they currently have, it doesn't get anything high enough. It's a test system. The only thing it can do is label people astronauts, right? it can't achieve anything else. It could potentially put
burn a lot of people's money.
Yeah. Yeah. It takes your money and gives you a label.
Yes. Money as propellant.
And so it could potentially put small astronauts, satellites into orbit, but it's not the most efficient way of doing that. In fact, there's cheaper things to do that. But what this is a complete test scale. They just have to make it 5 times bigger, and then they can go into better orbit. So, pretty cool. This is a new space age, man. Isn't it exciting?
Indeed.
Is that why they named that the Vim Emacs thing Space Max? Because it's a space age?
The new space age, yes.
So, you used to work for Google.
Yep.
And every week, Google does amazing things. What has it done this week?
Google has a lot of technology with regard to mapping. And I don't mean mapping in large scale, as in Google Maps and Street View. I'm talking about mapping inside areas. Like there's a feature of Google to be able to be inside of buildings, to know which floor stuff is on, things like that. Well, you need to map what is all, you know, around there. And that technology has been around for quite some time. Many of us are familiar with it in a Roomba. You have a sensor. It has to map the contours of the area, and that's how it's able to...
Okay, wait a second. I don't want to derail you from your topic at hand, which is mapping and cartography and all that, which is awesome. Mm-hmm. But a Roomba, I thought, completely was a randomized algorithm that basically just goes until it needs to charge again.
Right, but I'm trying to get the idea across. For them, they didn't have, you know, fast processors or a lot of storage on them to be able to do that problem. Right. But as time goes on, wouldn't that be useful to know where the obstacles are ahead of time and be able to chart your path?
In robotics, you know, contests in high schools and colleges, what they will regularly do is have a defined maze size, like it's going to be 10 feet by 10 feet, and your path is this big, and there's just walls. And you have to achieve going from one point to the other. One tactic is to make a really smash, really fast, really stupid thing that just goes as fast as it possibly can until it gets there, right? Bumping into walls, mm-hmm. the whole thing. The other one is, and that's one way to win, the other one is to do that relatively fast, but at the same time map it. So you might lose the first attempt, but you have to do it in 5 attempts, and the last attempt you're going to drive perfectly there, right? So there's different tactics in this, and mapping is one of them.
Right. I do want to mention, just for the sake of folks who are out there, in this case we're going to get a correction, that the newest Roombas do actually map their surroundings.
Now they do.
Mm-hmm. Well, this technology has tended to be very ad hoc. People have had to reinvent the wheel or do it in-house. Google has a bit of software called Cartographer, which is basically this. You have a sensor, and then you have a thing that figures out like how you're moving, and then is able to correlate that data so that you have a map of the area,
mm-hmm.
Of a room, for example. And so they have open sourced this. And if you go up to our website, you can get a link to that and find out more if you want to make your own own space mapping. Different type of space.
Environment mapping.
Yes.
Location, geographic, cryptography.
Personal space mapping.
What kind of inputs and outputs have you started hacking on this yet?
I have not.
It sounds fantastic. But I don't understand what the API would be. Like, you have to give it an image, or you get what kind of data can you give it?
Well, you can give it information as, they use LiDAR and stuff like that, but there is no reason why you couldn't use just a simple ultrasonic distance. What are they called again? Proximeter.
Proximeter. Okay.
And just use that as your inputs. It wouldn't be as fast as LiDAR, you know,
right,
on a wide range, but, you know, it doesn't really matter what or how limited your inputs are as long as you're willing to give it enough time. I mean, right?
Yeah, that makes sense. They're using this term in this article, they use this term SLAM, S-L-A-M.
Simultaneous localization and mapping.
Very cool. So I guess the idea is that you're generating a map as you go, or if you have a map, you can start associating where you are in the map and all the features necessary to do that. And it's cool that they're kind of saying, okay, so they say their focus is on advancing and demonstrating, democratizing SLAM. Again, what that was stands for? As a technology, currently Cryptographer is heavily focused on LiDAR SLAM, though continued development and community contributions, we hope to add both support for more sensors and platforms as well as new features such as lifelong mapping and localization in a pre-existing map. Okay, so they haven't done localization in a pre-existing map yet.
Yeah. Cool. SLAM, simultaneous localization and mapping.
Cool. Yeah. Oh, that sounds great. It makes sense that they'd open source that. Just because Google seems to do that all the time. Of course, the brains that are going into that is what's piloting their self-driving car.
Yeah, so something that I've found as a pattern with Google, and with Facebook for that matter, is that their tools for gathering the data, they have been making available,
mm-hmm.
And want others to build upon that and improve it and work out their own issues. The data that they have collected and that they collate and use, that's what is proprietary to them. That's what's important to them. The data they've collected and how they can analyze it and things like that. But the actual tools to gather it in the first place, they consider more of a commodity.
Right, right. Yeah, I mean, and what kind of examples of that are you seeing from Facebook?
Now you have me on the spot, and I can't remember off the top of my head. I guess I think of there are things like the React framework. Like for Facebook, it doesn't matter how they the tool they used to get people's eyeballs into Facebook, because the eyeballs are what's important, what's popular. The tool that they use to get there, not as much, and it's going to be more productive to have a lot of people using it and moving forward with it.
Right, right. Makes sense. Okay, cool.
Actually, I was just thinking another angle, which is that they're able to train the outside world on the technologies that they themselves use. For example, Facebook, React could have been an in-house project and just stayed there. Same with Angular at Google. But they release it, and people start using it and being experienced with it. And then if those same developers ever decide to come to Facebook or to Google or to LinkedIn, they will be cognizant of the tools and the libraries that are in use in-house.
Yeah, I mean, definitely getting developers up to speed quickly makes a lot of sense.
Like, there's no downside to that,
right? I mean, and a great example of that is Facebook announcing or releasing their open source project React and making a big, you know, awareness of it, mm-hmm. because so many people at Facebook were using React and continuing to use React, and if you just extend that out to the general populace as people come in, they're already aware of it, mm-hmm. which is pretty cool. React is a rendering framework for websites for web applications. And I could go way too deep into this if you want.
React is not a framework. Yeah,
but we won't go into that at this point. So let's talk a little bit about politics, and specifically about technology and policing. Years ago, Miles, you and I have seen a lot of things emerge in technology with regards to policing that we've paid attention to. Mm-hmm. An example of this that always kind of makes me be very conscious of our role as technical experts and sharing that knowledge with people is the idea of having police forces aware of where cars are all the time by continually scanning for license plates and having location information, which is an amazing...
Right, going to a mall and then scanning the parking lot.
Right. And just every time a police car now is driving around, it's picking up license plates and keeping a database of where those vehicles are.
Or at least the ones in San Jose. I don't know about other jurisdictions.
I'm sure it's spread to some degree. But it's a very useful feature, of course, for, well, let's say finding a stolen car. It's great. Mm-hmm. But even in investigating a situation later on, if you want to know if someone was at a certain location, you look at this database and you saw that vehicle was near there and that person owns that vehicle, you can actually start picking up stuff in retrospect. And I'm sure it's very useful in that regard.
Right. And in the UK, you have closed circuit TV cameras all over London.
They do very similar things.
And so you're able to map out where anyone was at any given part of the day.
Including facial recognition. I think mm-hmm. the police cars in San Jose are just doing license plate recognition, mm-hmm. but just a matter of time before they do facial recognition as well. Why wouldn't you? And film all the time. So in any case, these technologies are important for us to pay attention to because, of course, it's behooving upon us to make sure that our legislation understands how these technologies work and therefore what they should and shouldn't be able to do with regards to privacy and safety and all those things. So a new one that's been emerging, and we haven't had a lot of talking about it on this show, is the use of police to have police cameras or body cams recording mm-hmm. what they're doing all the time. The squad cars have done this for a long time. We have a lot of footage of squad car cameras. But now cameras being on the lapels of a police officer produces a really interesting artifact. You want to talk about this story a little bit?
Yes. We've actually talked about this in Southern California, Pasadena area, I believe it was, where we saw a huge drop in complaints against the police. Well, study from Cambridge University was looking at complaints against police officers as their metric over the course of 2014-2015.
Okay.
And looking at that is the equivalent of 1.4 million hours logged by almost 2,000 police officers. Like I said, this is both the U.S. and the U.K. And what they found was in the year before they started their study, there were 1,500-plus complaints filed against officers for, you know, excessive force or...
Just complaints.
Who knows? It could have been from all the way from rudeness to, you know, excessive force. And by the time the body camera experiment ended, they that year had only 113 complaints. So a drop of over 90%.
90% drop in complaints for the officers that were wearing body cams. Did they do the same period
Actually,
of time?
Actually, no. It was for officers that were wearing body cams and officers that weren't. Both.
So it was across two different periods of time then. So you had the before the police cams and
no,
after
I mean,
police
some,
cams?
Some police officers don't have cameras.
Right. So I just want to know what the drop is. Is it over one period of time, over a secondary period of time, or at the same period of time, whether a camera was present or not?
No.
That's very important.
Different periods of time.
Different periods of time. So one argument would be that it's not the cameras, it's some other artifact. We don't know necessarily.
Right.
But,
and it may very well be citizen cameras.
Right. But 95% change is something you should definitely pay attention to.
Yes.
Now, I'm assuming that complaints, formal complaints against officers, is a metric that's useful? Because one thing you could say is that, I'm just going to be completely flippant here, but let's say all complaints against police officers are fake. They're not true. The police officer is always operating in perfect conduct. So therefore, when a camera's being filmed and the person wants to make a complaint and they know there was a recording of it, they won't make the complaint.
Right.
Right? There's more than one reason.
That was something they were talking about the Pasadena Police Department years ago, was that everyone was acting on their best behavior because there was a record. So fewer complaints.
Oh, so that's
was...
a secondary thing, is that it didn't escalate into a situation where a person felt like they needed to complain because they were aware there's a camera there anyway, and so they were actually operating differently than the police officer.
No, just along the lines of it wasn't just a my word against yours situation anymore. It became there's going to be a camera, and that's going to keep the police officer in line, but it also means that you are responsible for your actions because there is a camera involved.
Right. I mean, there's basically three different things, right? The police officer is going to treat people potentially better because they're on film all the time. The person is going to potentially not escalate anything more, you know, do things that they, because they're going to be on their best behavior. So those are two persons. Then the third one I was talking about was the person is... was going to make a complaint anyway, fictitiously, but now there's a camera showing that they would be wrong, so they don't make the complaint. I think the latter is probably unlikely to have any real bearings. I've heard that police officers can control whether the camera's on or off.
That is by policy, depending upon which department. Different departments have different policies. Some have the cameras automatically turn on. Some of them, they are, you know, you will... say that the camera must automatically turn on when you leave the vehicle. But there are also cases where if it's not enforced, because there have been cases where police officers will come out and there is no body cam footage and they'll say, oh, well, I didn't charge the battery. Oh, or I forgot to turn it on, things like that. Even though, like in the case of an LAPD officer a while ago, just popping into my memory, even though him not turning it on was against the department policy at the time. So if you have a department that is very strict about that and going to follow up, then you're probably going to get a better compliance than one that goes, oh, well, that just didn't happen this time. Oh, well.
Right. So one of the pieces that this study talks about is that it's actually hard to use formal complaints as a metric in studying situations because they are so rare. And therefore, and if you have a rare occurrence, it's very hard to see a statistical validity of the decrease of that occurrence, right? It could just be an anomaly. And so this study does address that concern, and that's actually why they did it over such a long period of time, so that it could take that rare occurrence and be assured that it had deviated enough to make the claim. The claim they're making is
statistically
valid.
Right, and they can also look at
the
amount of – they can look at historical data for how many complaints over year and see that this is a very noticeable aberration. And the question as to why it happened, the researchers can't really say that definitively, just because you run into the risk of correlation is not equal to causation. Do we know if it's because of the body cams? Do we know if it's because of increased cell phone usage? Is it because of more stuff going into media like Black Lives Matter? Is it because police officers are responding to criticisms and are now being more careful with their conduct? Any of these things are possibilities and more. But it is, at least on the surface, good to know that there are fewer reasons for a citizen to come forward and have a complaint.
Right. The other thing to note about formal complaints is that...
Actually, I shouldn't say citizen. That's one actually one person? Of my pet peeves. Why? Yeah. Because the police are not military. So referring to citizens as in non-police...
Police are citizens.
Is a misnomer and lends toward the police being treated as a military, and I don't believe that they should be considered as such or are such.
Right. So to be clear about formal complaints with police officers, it's actually not totally representational about problems that exist, right? A formal complaint denotes an instance where you can actually show there was a wrong, but the just general power of power disimbalance, if it's already accepted in society, it's not something that's going to come up as a formal complaint, right? Mm-hmm. And so it's important to understand that difference. It's also important to understand whether this study was because of the police officer operating differently or the citizen operating differently or both. And the reason, I mean, do you feel it's important in that regard? I mean, if people are having a better time, they're not complaining as much, is that the goal in itself? Or is the goal, I mean, what do you feel the goal of the camera is?
Accountability. It's having a third eye to be able to look at it. And I believe I said citizen when I meant to say civilian earlier. But it's that idea of if you have a video camera, because eyewitness testimony is severely flawed. We like to think of the Law and Order episode where someone says, yes, I saw that person do this, and that's the way it was, and the person gets conviction, and everything is, you know, wraps itself up by the end of the episode. When in reality, eyewitness testimony is heavily flawed. It's actually one of the more suspect forms of evidence. And we don't think of it that much, but how many times have you gotten into an argument with your spouse because you both were at a certain thing, a certain place in a certain time, but you both saw wildly different things? Or one missed something important to the situation that the other one caught. And so you have a video camera because that makes everyone an eyewitness of sorts.
Yeah.
And there is the comment of, well, you don't see everything in the situation with the camera with that limited field, but the flip side is you don't see everything as a human being because our brains and our eyes are limited fields as well.
And additionally, we have the problem that does not deal with digital video of our memories changing.
Right.
So over time,
the more you think about something,
and we become less credible. But the video image, however representational is or not, at least is consistent in over time. So the other thing to note here is that regardless of the motivation of the logging, so regardless of whether the complaint was a justified complaint or if the officer is no longer inducing complaints, the truth of the matter is, no matter what the case is, lowering the complaint count is better for the police department, right? Because complaints cost time and energy and research. So if you do reduce complaints at some level, that is beneficial. Especially considering we can assume really clearly that it's not that people are being pushed out of making the complaint. They probably are having more satisfaction to some level because there's a record of it. You know, I mean, that logically denotes. I mean, of course, a study is hard to say that in words. But in any case, really interesting article. The full article is available. You can read the entire thing from Sage Journals, sagepub.com. And it's linked to, of course, from geekspeak.org. We are, is that the last story for us today, Miles?
No, I actually wanted to go a little bit further into the political realm. And I apologize for everyone for going a little overload. But something that came across Twitter recently caught my attention. And I wanted to discuss it with you, which is right after the debate, the most recent U.S. presidential debate between Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump. And one of the big takeaways from there was Donald Trump was espousing a policy choice that was diametrically opposed to his running mate. So within the same platform, there was a strong disagreement. And in fact, there was quite a bit of consternation coming from the Pence side of the camp to say, like, what is this? And there was even talk of him dropping out. I don't know what's come of that. I don't believe he has. But right after the debate was over, a tweet came up from Mike Pence, the running mate for Donald Trump.
From Mike Pence, the Twitter account.
Yeah, at Mike Pence, saying, congrats to my running mate at Real Donald Trump on a big debate win. Proud to stand with you as we make America great again, or hashtag it, MAGA.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And someone, people on Twitter have mentioned, like, this is what a scheduled tweet looks like. Like, it wasn't that he actually thought this from watching the debate. It's you assume that was going to be, or that was going to be part of the optics for after the debate was over.
Or, and so you scheduled quite likely, the person that's managing his Twitter account, the media company or media person that's managing the Twitter account, scheduled that to be, because that's the appropriate thing to do
right.
when your colleague does a presentation. You want to give feedback to them. And scheduling makes a lot of sense. Of course, there's no way to know whether it was scheduled or actually typed in by him or by one of his staffers. Why do you think that's a problem? What question does that raise for you?
Because many people were referring to the debate as Donald Trump throwing Mike Pence under the bus for a quick short-term sniping at Hillary Clinton during the debate.
Mm.
And
why is that throwing Pence under the bus?
To say that all the things that this guy has been talking about on the campaign trail, forget about that because it's not actually what the president is going to do.
So he was undermining
usually,
what Prince
usually
has
been a saying. Vice president and president try to be on the same page with regard to policy
so
choices,
I,
so
I
that they can have the same voice when talking to.
I haven't watched the debate,
it was kind of painful to watch. But
okay,
yeah.
But so what kind of thing can give me? So I didn't understand that was the case. Is that Trump was saying some things that was counter to what Pence had been saying? So
yes,
they weren't in alignment, basically, with what their message
very is. Very much like in direct opposition. The moderator was actually pointing that out, going, this is the exact opposite of what are you? And so this reminds me of how technology is influencing our elections. You have this.
Sure.
You have tweet feeds that are doing fact checks.
Mm-hmm.
But you also have – so you have this technology that is allowing us to go in real time to say, wait, no, what he said was wrong. Oh, wait, no, what he said was right. Wait, no, that doesn't fit the facts. That does. You know.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, as a nation, we are moving further and further from caring whether or not the facts fit up or not.
But do you think that's that correlates from the ability to look things up quickly?
Do
you think they correlate in any way? Do you think there's a reason? I mean, you're saying in one hand we're faster to know knowledge than we've ever had before, and we're moving away from actually caring about that. Do you think there's some kind of correlation between those two things?
There might be in the sense of cognitive dissonance. We don't like information that runs counter to our personal view of how the world works. So if something comes up and it's a fact check and it runs counter to what you believe, then you're going to call the fact checker into question.
Oh, and therefore you start questioning whether the facts are important.
Right. And once you start doing that,
then you have a problem.
Then you really start going into, this is my team and I know that my team is right. So anything that messes with that is going to be considered suspect and wrong. Hence like terms like liberal media or the right-wing echo chamber, that type of thing.
Right.
Where we just dismiss what is being said simply because we don't like who is speaking it. We don't like the conclusions they've drawn.
Right.
Regardless of their merit. So, yeah, and especially because technology is coming in, like email, having to do with this is now showing up as a feature of presidential debates. Especially with Hillary Clinton and her emails, the 33,000 deleted after the subpoena, blah, 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 blah. I don't mean to make light of that. I just mean this is an ongoing
technology
is major finding role. Its way into our social discourse with regard to politics that it didn't apply before.
Right.
Like you wouldn't have a conversation about email in the presidential debates between Jimmy Carter and Ronald Reagan. Like it just – and – having to navigate that and figure out what is actually important, what isn't, how do you have accountability? Because technology also makes us more accountable. There's more of a trail in many cases.
Absolutely.
Yeah,
a lot of the correspondence that would have occurred in replace of email would have been memos, much harder to get copies of and potentially not hold on to successfully, or phone calls. Of course, we have had technology play a major role with recordings of phone calls. The Nixon era recordings are a perfect example of that. So technology does play a major role in how we talk about politics, and it has for quite a long time. But you're right that it's a different level at this point. Additionally, there's more mystery about that, right? The idea that you could have a recording going on all the time does one thing, but that you're always constantly creating text that never goes away is a completely different kind of world.
that concern for all the kids coming up now that have Facebook accounts through their teenage years, where folks our age are able to have our photos from that time, but they are in our possession, and for the most part, we've lost them anyway. And so digging up the dirt, as it were, if we decided to go for a political career is much harder than it will be in 30 years from now, when the next generation starts going into politics and their entire life has been documented and videotaped.
I have a friend who I grew up with, and he, at one point in his rebellious era, rebelled from, in his 16-year-old or whatever, he rebelled from his hippie upbringing and started believing in the Church of Satan, I think is what it was. He's not like that at all anymore. quite the contrary. But at the time in his life, he was like that. And he was interviewed by a local paper about his views on race and whatever. And his ignorant young mind just spurred off racial comments and insulting, horrible crap. And that went on into the paper. Kind of a problem, not very good. You could research anytime you wanted. Mm-hmm. You knew his name, you could find it. But then, of course, later, the paper went online and took all their archives and made them text available for searching. So now when you search for his name and you do the right era of time or some question, something he met, there it is. There's his great, horrible quote that's just him being an ignoramus at 16. And that was just one instance where he happened to be interviewed by the paper. But there are people doing that on Facebook right now all the time, or Twitter, whatever. And though their views might change, some things, it's very hard to forgive someone because of their age or stupidity.
Right, and what do you do? Do you try to institute a law that says the right to be forgotten for anyone under the age of 18? Like,
maybe. Maybe that's appropriate. I don't know. It would depend, I guess. GeekSpeak is a registered service mark of David Lawrence and is used with permission. And GeekSpeak is Creative Commons Attribution 3.0. You can use our stuff, reuse our stuff, any way you'd like. You can even make money on it. Just give us some credit. I want to thank Greg Merkley, our Canadian correspondent geek, who provided this week's working title, Samsung's Map of Police Complaints Doomed. And also thank you to Michael Newman of PetStar Music, who provided our theme song. And thank you for being here for episode 42 of season 16. A big thanks to our patrons. We currently have 25 active patrons donating at least $1 a month to support this program. The $110 we received in September covers our bandwidth costs and allows us to spend a bit on marketing in order to bring the show to more people. In September, we were supported by Chris Irwin, Pat Hader, Glenn Nelson, Alexis Chen, Nirajis Plenius, and 19 other people. Thank you so much for supporting our program. If you'd like to join these wonderful people in helping to financially support GeekSpeak, please visit geekspeak.org/support or help spread the word directly by writing us a review or letting others know you like our program. Miles and I have been doing this show for 16 years, and when we see people contribute financially to the show, we know we're doing something right. Thank you very much. Miles Elam?
Yes, Lyle Troxell.
Thank you so much for being here tonight.
Always a pleasure.
Get any post-show stuff? I'm kind of into talking about politics more.
I am having fun playing with PostgreSQL.
Yeah, let's do that.
If you want to talk about politics.
No. Good. PostgreSQL. PostgreSQL, of course, is an open source database. It is a SQL system. It's a relational database
management system.
Yes. And very similar to MySQL. If you've heard of MySQL, they're very similar in a lot of ways. Postgres has maintained its purity in the open source perspective, as in free liberty kind of open source. Who owns it?
It also cares a lot more about whether or not your data remains safe.
We've been using Postgres for the GeekSpeak website for years. I don't even know how long, but maybe relatively quickly after we stopped working on Microsoft products together 10 years or 15, 16 years ago.
I was already playing with PostgreSQL while we were at Feed the Monster.
Yeah, okay. But I guess we didn't really do the GeekSpeak website till 2000-something when we switched away from XML. any case, PostgreSQL has been kind of the de facto, whenever I have an option to run a relational database, that's the database I'll choose. It's got data integrity at a level that's a little different than MySQL, is what you kind of referred to.
MySQL has improved tremendously since I first started maligning it, so I have to be fair there. And PostgreSQL used to be much slower than MySQL, which was one of the reasons why people chose MySQL as well, mm-hmm. the speed aspect, although PostgreSQL has closed that gap as well. So
MySQL also at this point now is a subsidiary of Oracle, or I mean, Oracle owns it and controls it, right?
Yes, although that was split off, and there's MariaDB, and that one is...
That one also went commercial recently.
Right. It's also... it's always had a dual license agreement, which mm-hmm. is it had a GPL version 2, which means that if you make any code changes, or make anything that touches that code, including the database driver itself, then your application needed to be GPL as well. And if you didn't want to do that, you got a commercial license.
You could buy a license and get a license meaning that anything you did was private source, but it cost you.
Right. Yeah. But it was also an aspect of the people who owned the copyright on MySQL was, at the time, MySQL AB, and it has changed over time. Oracle now has it now. And you had a core bit of developers. If you ever tried to send a patch to MySQL to fix something, they would take it as long as you were willing to assign copyright to them.
Right, which actually is kind of important when you're dealing with a commercial license. If you're then going to make money off of it and have a license where it can be private, if there's code in there from someone who didn't agree to that, you got a problem. So that's a common way of dealing with that problem.
But this is in contrast to many open source communities where you have a common ownership.
Yeah.
Here, it's very clear who owns it, in this case, Oracle or the folks behind MariaDB. And everyone else can contribute, their volunteer their time, but there is no actual recognition for that. There's no...
Right.
There's no stake, no personal stake. You don't get stock in it, and are able to exercise a choice, no matter how small it may be. With regard to PostgreSQL and other Firebird databases, the same way too. The license is different. They're BSD licenses, which are not people refer to them as viral, but if you take the code and you make changes, you don't have to make those changes available for others to use. All you have to do is say, hey, I got this code based off of
similar project. Right, similar to the MIT licenses. So, yeah. And Apache too, also.
I guess we could do a show on licenses.
Let's not, though. That's kind of boring. What has been exciting to you about Postgres lately?
Aside from speed improvements, that and this has been happening for the last 10 years, speed has just been wonderful. They've added just features that I thought were really neat.
So neat that you decided to develop on them.
Right. One of the issues that we've had with the current system, or at least what I considered an issue, was you had a database table that had, here's where the show audio is, and these are the teaser images and stuff like that. But the actual data was stored on the file system as files, which meant that if you needed to make a backup of the database, you didn't have the files. And if you had the files, you didn't have the database. And they could easily get out of sync if things were coded wrong. Or
absolutely.
If there was something...
Or just that example of backing things up and such. We used to actually take... We've never had the audio files in the database. We used to have the audio files in a very specific naming structure that in the database... There was just a field that represented, that we had audio or not. And then it would generate a link on the web page or in the XML document that would point to where the file should be. There was no correlation whether it was there or not. And so that was a manual process. The newer system, actually, you upload the audio file through a web interface. It saves it to disk. And when it does that, it actually makes a new record in the audio episodes table. And that has a location of where the file is on the file system. As you said, both those systems have this problem of something has to make sure that the file still exists in the file system and the entries exist in the database. And if they don't correlate, you've got a problem. So when I imported, for example, when I moved to the newer system from an older one that was XML-based, I had all these audio files and I had to write a script that went through all the audio files and made sure there was an entry that mapped to the episode, right? Like I had to backport right. a script basically to do that. to have those things be linked. And right. of course, if the episode didn't exist in the database, then I had this weird problem of like, well, I've got an audio file that doesn't have a show, so I'll just generate a show that says unknown show. You know, it was like kind of a mess.
Right. And the feature in PostgreSQL, and this is not unique to PostgreSQL, there are many other database vendors that are doing it. It's called foreign data wrappers or SQL Med. I won't get into it, but
basically it's like it's a virtual table to some degree that is generated yes. by some other means.
Yeah, foreign table, foreign data wrapper refers to data that does not exist in the database. It exists foreign to the database.
Yeah.
So it could be in the case of what I've been working on, a view of the file system showing up as database tables that you can then query and do joins against and stuff like that.
So then in that scenario, you'd have a directory of audio files with the rules understanding that reading them, and then you'd have this kind of wrapper to that Postgres used to actually access that data. And so the table didn't really exist at all, but was generated from the file system completely.
Right.
But you could access it like it was a table.
It means the application doesn't have to dip its toe into both worlds. It can be an application that just deals with manipulating files and doing stuff, or it can be something that does database queries, and still everything is always reflective of what reality is.
Mm-hmm.
If you delete a file off of the file system, the entry in that foreign table, that virtual table, ceases to exist.
Right.
And so you still have the issues of you need to make backups and you need to make sure that things are there, but it won't ever tell you that something is there when it isn't.
Right, right. That makes sense. And in some ways, the system that to recode this to work this way is a minor change, right? Basically, you now have a tool that allows you to upload a file.
Right.
These are once things that happens, built you're into, kind of done.
Yeah.
Of course, you'd have to make sure the file was named correctly so the file system actually mapped to some kind of data structure and integrity. We almost always do have that structure. I think right. the structure right now is that every audio file is actually in a directory structure that goes episodes, year, month, day. And we don't normally do – we've never done more than one episode a day, so we're okay in that format for now.
Right. And we're working on that, actually.
Yeah. So, you know, I've been working on, I think, the current system we've had up since 2006, effectively, a Ruby on Rails app. And I've definitely needed to improve it and change it and haven't done it as fast as I should because, of course, it's a volunteer kind of gig.
Yeah, day job,
yeah,
kids.
Day job, kids, all that stuff. But, you know, whenever you talk about changing the data structure, like this change, for example, it rises in me that, okay, now I've got to, you know, Miles wants to make this thing that kind of cleans things up. But now that means I've got to make tools that actually use this new system. And so it's always this question of like, well, what's in some level, what things do we need to work on versus not work on? And what things you know, of course, the big motivation for us doing this show is because we like to do it. So if you like figuring out how to do file system virtualization in a data structure, it's cool. Do we use it? I guess so.
Yeah. How to get a large scale database system or a database that's geared toward larger scales of data and have it run on a Raspberry Pi.
There's that aspect that you're running on a Raspberry Pi.
In the living room.
And so it's when I see this kind of development going on and you're excited about it, I go, oh, okay, now I got to write something. And of course, when we started out, like our relationship started out with you were a back-end engineer and front-end engineer as well, generating all this content for radio stations, rendering all these websites for radio stations. And I was hired to come in to make sure people could put data into your system. Right. Our relationship is founded off this idea is you design beautiful, wonderful systems that do all this wonderful output. And I have to figure out how to friggin' fill that stuff with content. And it's challenging.
Well, but we've also kind of morphed. Now you're doing more back end stuff. And now I'm doing more stuff of how to get the user interaction to get the data in. Like we're kind of scooting around.
We go around back and forth. Yeah. Absolutely. But, you know, to be clear, I'm a UI engineer. That's what I do. And you're playing with databases. I mean, they're not the same kind of things. I mean, anyway. But I'm always challenged by this because I don't know where to get excited by what you're doing and follow you or ignore what you're doing and just keep on doing what I'm doing. I don't ever know where that line is.
Right. And because we're doing it for fun, like the only reason to get involved is if you actually care.
Yeah. So today, though, when you brought your bot online, in our chat room. We use Slack to manage the show. So all of us geeks that talk about the show, we use that through, we use Slack and invite people. And if you ever use Slack, it's a great application. If you haven't used it, I should say, it's a great application. It's like a messaging system and chat room system that has a really good interface and good apps. You can use it on your phone, get notified, and all that stuff.
And so, one of the things they do as a company is promote you making bots. In other words, programs that can interact with their system. And since it's a chat application or a messaging application, that means listening to what people are saying. This is not like just as a creepy Big Brother thing.
Totally is a creepy Big Brother
thing. Oh, stop. No, this is because Slack, it has specific teams. You can't just randomly connect to anyone. This is within the group. Where it will listen to what people say and then respond to it if it deems appropriate.
For example, today you set up a thing that said, so I was like, hey, people, who's on the show? Because I was thinking that we'd record it at a different location than normally do. And I hadn't had responses to a Google Calendar entry, and I was kind of curious what was going on. And so you wrote back, I'll be there. And then the sentence...
I said, who is coming?
Who is coming? Question mark. And a bot called Geekbot responded with, these people are coming, and these people haven't replied yet. Kind of pestering people to get engaged with the calendar. Which basically means that you write a small application that connects to Slack, also accesses our Google Calendar, shared Google Calendar, mm-hmm. checks who responded, who hasn't responded, and where the location is, and prints that all back to the server whenever you type this, who's coming.
Right.
Or where's the show? I can't remember the queries are. The challenging
with
these
things... Yeah, where are we recording? Yeah.
The challenging is that someone then tried to do who's coming, or who's coming with an apostrophe S instead of
which
who
should
is.
Have worked, but the regular expression did not match. For some reason, I still need to debug that.
Regular expressions are always tricky. Anyway, if you want to know how this bot is written and everything, it's all, of course, on GitHub under Miles's. We'll link to it from today's show, but under Miles' account, which is the tech formerly known as Elam?
As Miles Elam. Yeah. Or Miles? TTFKAM, yeah.
Yeah. Which is just the initials of that. And, of course, it could also do randomization, things like that, which are kind of fun.
Yeah, which was almost clever when Prince actually was named the artist formerly known as Prince. And over time has just become kind of sad. But hey, it's the moniker I have now, so that's what I'm
Hey, your
use.
Geekbot is still running.
Oh, yeah, because my laptop is on. It's running from my laptop, not from the Pi.
So one of the things that you also put in is probably the example code of rolling dice for you?
Yes.
Is that the example code?
Well, no. I was trying to figure out what to do that would be of interest to you. There was also that notion of like, what do? We could do this, we could do this. And I thought like, well, wouldn't it be interesting if we could say like flip a coin? And then went, well, the other geeks are total D&Ders, role players, and as much as I give them crap for it, I should pay some homage to that. So you can say roll 2d6 or roll d20.
Well, you can also do things like roll 6d21. The d20 don't die doesn't work. It's not a geometrically balanced figure, right. But it works, which is kind of cool.
Right. And at first I thought like, oh, I could just ask for a random number, but then realized that, and this is something I thought was interesting, was the math for 2d6 is different than 1d12.
Of course. Definitely.
Right. Like, but we don't. Those
if
of us
you
who
don't play D&D, yeah. You don't think this way, but us right. D&D players totally understand.
Or if you don't play craps a lot, you know this.
Right, right.
That there's a lot, that's why 7 is so common.
Right, yeah,
it's
yeah.
It's like 7 is more common to show up because you can do 1 and 6, 2 and 5, 3
But didn't
three
you also
four.
Implement random?
Yes, and I had also implemented random from one number to another. So give me a random number from 5 to 25.
Oh, cool, like random 3-4, things like yeah. that. Yeah. What if you just do random 310?
Well, it's not going
to
match.
It doesn't do anything. You have to have a dash in it. Yeah. All right. Good to know. Anyway, it's kind of fun to do this. And at the same time, because of natural language, when we deal... This is the whole thing
this
that
isn't really natural
ago.
Language. This isn't really natural language processing. This right. is just do a quick regular expression to do a match. Does this look like a question that someone is asking that I can handle?
And some of the things that is going on with... systems in place, like Facebook a while ago said, hey, start making apps to our Messenger platform. And one of the things they did is they allow access to this really cool service that does natural language processing for you and then breaks down and tries to give intent from that natural language. So you don't have to do the hard part of trying to figure out when you ask for a question like, what's going on tonight? It right. actually does that for you with a question back. So if you implemented one of those systems in place, you wouldn't have to deal with the parsing of the natural language at all.
As a matter of fact, I did find a library that did natural language processing, and I I was just about to install it and get it to go. I realized, no, it wasn't the size thing. It's server-side, so it doesn't really matter.
Well, no, it matters if it's running on a Raspberry Pi, but go on.
No, not really, because one of the cool things about a bot, let's get some geekery here because we're unconstrained, is that you can have the bot receive the command and then send the little ellipses dots to let you know, like, I'm thinking about this. You know, so there is a feedback to let you know, so even if it takes a little while.
Why didn't you use this natural language?
Because there's, aside from the very basic questions that I was having it do now, there really wasn't much that I could think of that we needed a natural language processor for.
Right.
I was thinking, we're not checking the weather? I don't know.
Just pinging the bot should give the response of, what's the next show? Is there a topic yet? Who's on the show? Like, those things could just be the response. Like, it only has one response, really. Though, we've talked a lot about it being the general system for us gathering news and interacting with the show in general. So, I can see you start growing this thing. Greg just rolled a D1. Guess what he got?
Did he get a 1?
He did get a 1.
See, that would be a case where I would do a pattern match for, like, roll D1 or roll 0 D6, that type of thing, and then, you know, give a snide comment back instead of
This system would allow me to actually play Shadowbrook? Oh my gosh, I forgot the name of it. Shadowhawk? There's this great game where... Shadowrun? That's a movie, though, isn't it? As you played the game and got better and better, you'd get more D6. Four different things. So, like, so eventually you were like rolling 30 d6. You know how long it takes to roll and count 30 d6?
No, because I have better things to do with my life.
Hey, Greg rolled a d0 and got nothing from the bot. I wonder if it crashed. By the way, 30 d1 equals 30. So now you know.
It did not crash.
Oh, good. It just didn't understand that?
There is no division in that model. So there's no reason for it to do a divide by zero. So it's just multiplying by zero.
Yeah, but why wouldn't it give back zero? It didn't give back an answer.
Oh.
Oh, no, it said Greg roll zero. It just took a while. Is this running
latency.
All right, let's see. We didn't want to talk about politics. Yeah. We talked about Postgres, and we went into bots. Anything else about Postgres you want to mention? I thought it was really interesting, the bit mapping you were doing for commenting. And you talked a lot about that, but you've moved on away from that now.
Yeah, that was mostly because, like, comments, it was interesting how to solve that problem. And I think I came up with a very elegant solution to it that was very performant. And
yeah, we don't actually need it for GeekSpeak, but it's very cool.
No, it would have been really useful for GeekSpeak as long as we wanted to take on the burden of comments.
We used to run a messaging system, a PHP chat. What are those called?
PHPBB, the bulletin board system.
And what would happen is we had a lot more questions than we had time to answer. So we just stopped doing it, unfortunately.
Well, I was thinking it would be useful for people to answer questions for each other. But
yeah,
as you start to get any... if you don't have enough people, it just ends up looking like a ghost town and it's kind of discouraging to folks. If you end up with a lot of people doing it, once you hit a certain critical mass, you have a lot of people just trying to screw around with the system.
Right, you get spam and stuff. We had a lot of
which
that.
Means you need to have an overseer go in and look and
okay,
try to
so
clean
let's
it
talk
up.
About the problems with commenting. And I'll try to show the general relational data structure problem because that's an interesting one. But you know what? Maybe this is too boring for most people. You want to talk about this?
Well, I could talk about just
the
data structure issue.
Let's say you want to make a comment on a show, on something. So you make a comment, and then someone wants to reply to your comment. So then their comment's not about the original thing. Their comment is about your comment. And in fact, when you view them, you want to see it hierarchical. You want to see that this person's talking about this.
Well,
other
there's
comments
a question. Happen. Do you want to have comments just be flat and it's just
if
temporal,
you wanna,
like
if
whatever
you
happened?
If you want to do comments flat, this is not a problem.
Which is how
solving.
Facebook was for a long time, right. How MySpace was.
Yeah, but in Facebook right now, when someone makes a comment on a post, then someone else can make a comment on that comment, and then the thread can keep deviating. Now, I think Facebook actually limits it to, like, too deep.
Yeah.
So it can be a tree to some degree.
Well, Facebook may keep it deeper than that, but they don't present it in the UI.
Yeah, I would assume that that's the way they do it. They just, like, you don't need to keep going deeper and deeper in these things. But you'll definitely see on Reddit, they can keep going deep and deep. There's no result ending. And so the problem emerges when you want to select all the comments from a system in a table that are, and sort them in a way that makes sense hierarchical. Because in this table system, you're not going to have in numbers of tables That doesn't make any sense. What instead you're going to do is you're going to have one comment table, and in there you're going to have like a parent ID and the child ID, and then maybe a sort order if they're the same.
Well, the
siblings.
Comment ID and then a parent ID, yeah.
Well, comment ID and a parent ID, but also you have to have a sort order, because if you have two comments that are siblings to each other, they have the same parent, they still have to have a sort.
In general, at least in my experience, you just do a time that you added
time
them, and then, you just do it in
and then it's creation time in case they get edited, they always stay in order. Okay, so you got those three things. You've got your date, which gives you your order. You've got your parent ID, which gives you your tree structure. And so then when you say, I want all the comments of this thing that's being, let's just say the root is a comment, because it's easier that way. So you have a comment, and then there's all these children and different things. If you want to select them all, you have to say, give me the comment, and then give me all the children of that comment, and then give me all the children of each of those comments, and pretty soon your SQL query gets complex.
Or you start making as many queries as you have depth.
Yes. And that is actually a problem that emerges with speed problems and things of that nature.
Right. That if to make a single view of a comment thread and have to make five queries to your database, you know, five round trips is just
it's a mess.
Yeah, it's untenable.
Additionally,
it doesn't scale very
additionally, well. To some degree, you have to put that all in memory at some level, because you then have to make sure you can then render something that has all that comment and depth.
Right.
So it's not like you're just doing chunk at a time. Yeah. You have to kind of store it in cache. And now, that's a problem for web server.
Yeah. Now, as it happens, PostgreSQL has a feature called with recursive. Which will allow
which
it to do these the equivalent of those multiple calls without having to have the return trip five times.
But you still have the memory problem of going, do you have the comments in order? I mean, if you have the right comments, you basically it has to
you still have the speed issue,
temporally
yeah.
and then has to be parsed about pagination becomes really challenging. Anyway.
Right. So I made a bit mask.
Okay.
This,
so what's a bit mask, Miles?
Well,
actually, let's talk about IP addresses now.
Yeah. Yeah. It's... It's
okay. First, wait. What
you have? You have a number. Let's say you
made
have
a new field. You made a new field,
right?
And what's the field called?
Thread ID.
Thread ID. Okay. And what type is that field? Is it text or is it numbers? What is it?
It's a number. It's a 64-bit integer.
Okay, so it can be a number from 1 to 6 million, or no?
Oh no, 64
bit,
16
quadrillion,
sextillion, or
huge,
something like that.
Giant,
yeah.
giant number. So it's one to that. Okay.
Yeah. And so I start encoding values into it. So the you know, this 4 bits refers it you know,
so
split
the first,
up into 4 bits.
So you when know, you say bits, chunks, you're talking about the first 4 slots of numbers, if you will.
Well,
in binary.
In binary, when you're talking about 64 bits, that's, you know, 2 to the 64th power. It's
yes.
Each one is a bit and each one, you know, adds up. And so splitting that off into 4 bits at a time or the like means that you can have, you know, 0 to 16 in those. Now, I've modified it quite a bit so that you can have more than 16 per level. But what a feature of that, a side effect of that, is that if you ask for the comments in thread order, ordered by thread and by that ID,
because yeah, you haven't really given all of us the picture of what this mask and such is. You kind of talked about it, but let me try to translate this for you. Let's talk about the most significant block for a second. We'll really simplify
sure.
this.
Sure.
Let's just say that you can only, it's a binary, let's make it very short, small, not 64-bit character, but let's talk about it.
I feel like I need to do like a video feed
you
of
probably
this,
do.
Yeah.
Yeah. In fact, you probably should. It's kind of a cool feature. So let's say we just have 8 bits, okay? So 8 bits is what, 64? Integer 64?
256. 256. 0 to 255.
Okay. Okay. So in this situation, we're just going to do ones and zeros. You can just imagine them 8 wide, okay?
Uh-huh.
And so the first 4 of them, 0, 1, 0, 0, whatever, that right there would be the comment itself. So the very first group of them would be how many original comments you'd have.
Right.
No parents or children or anything. So the first time you do this, it would be 0, 0, 0, 1. That means that's the very first comment in the system. And
followed
then,
by a whole bunch of zeros after that.
Right. And then if you want to make a comment about that post, the ID for the first comment about the first of that comment would be 0, 0, 0, 1, and then 0, 0, 0, 1. So this represents the first child comment.
Yeah, if you're talking about 4 bits, you were talking
right.
about...
Right.
Okay.
Okay, there's more of them after
right.
this. We're just talking
we'll
about the
first
groups.
We'll use 4-bit buckets because that's easier
so much
to
easier. Yeah.
say zeros.
So then, if you want to make a comment again to that original comment, your number would be 0001 to say, I'm a child of that first comment, and then 0010, representing that you're the second comment of the first, right?
Right, which it completely lost people. It requires, it probably requires a visual.
It might. So then you just keep on doing that down the line, which allows you to have 250 root comments to every comment. Right. And you could have that, I mean, you 64-bit wide, you're talking about a lot of depth.
Right, and it allows for things to be at most 8 levels deep.
Right.
And if you have cool it fixed like that.
And the cool thing is because of Postgres' ability to do selects.
No, actually, any database could, this could work with any database.
What's the select statement to say I want all comments and it's
in thread order?
Yeah.
You say order by thread ID.
Yeah, but could you say I want the 0001 and anything under that? Like that's, you have to do a match.
Yes. So what you would do is, and this could be with any database system, just about any popular database system, you do a bitwise mask, which is you mask against, let's say you want just the first comment and all of its children.
Children, yeah.
So let's say that's 00000001,
mm-hmm.
And then a whole bunch of zeros after that is the first comment. If I mask out to say 00000000, I'm going to do this in hexadecimal, it's easier. If I mask this out to be 01 followed by a whole bunch of Fs, in other words, all the bits are set after that, and I say give me all of those that will
it's
match
an or
up.
That, if you will.
Yeah, mm-hmm. That will match up to – or that –
so it's a bitwise select.
If I and it with it, will it end up with the same, you know?
So it's a, so tell me in SQL what that is.
It's a bitwise operator. So yeah. A bitwise and or bitwise
so
or
select,
is how you're able to
select
do
star where bitwise 1F to 1-2. I mean, how, what's the, you know what I'm saying? I mean, I could do as an integer. I could say below this number and above this number, and that would also do it.
That's the thing, I have to go back in my algorithm to get this right.
But the cool thing
is
that the one index on this system, on that one field, allows you to sort it and grab them all that way, and also grab any child at any point and all of its comments.
Yeah. Oh, that was it. You actually do a FF to match up with that first one, and then the rest of are zeros, and then you say, give me an and on that.
Mm-hmm.
And if the block, the bitwise blocks, an and with zero is always going to be zero. It's like true and false is going to be
true.
False.
True and false.
And so if I say give me everything that is a bitwise match to the top level is going to give me all of the siblings that match that.
Right.
Or all of the children, rather. Sorry.
Cool. Okay, I think we got geeky enough there. We stretched into politics for a second, and then we went crazy.
Now, the hard part is, how do you make it so that it's not just fixed to 255 entries per level, and how do you make it so that it isn't limited to just 8 levels deep?
And you achieve that?
Yes.
Next time on Geek Speak.
Yeah. And what do you do when you reach the limit? Do you then it becomes like policy decisions? Like, what do you do? Do you just assume that it's?
I mean, of course, the simple way to do this that you talked about with me last time we chatted about this privately was that first grouping you don't make the same size; you make it larger, so you can have a lot more original comments.
Yeah.
And then you can
that's the typical pattern.
Typical pattern is like if you're 60 levels deep, you're not going to have a thread with over 250 messages inside it. Like you're kind of done at that point. Maybe you'll have 100 and that's it.
Right.
So you'd have kind of the tree could only get a certain
once
depth.
You start getting to that level, you really just have two people replying to each other.
Right.
Or the same person replying to themselves because they're trying to break the system.
And as it regards to the importance in society, it doesn't. So you can just ignore them. That's how we do computer engineering, right?
Yeah, sure.
Some level. Yeah. By the way, Greg has gone crazy. You can actually, your bot is doing fine with 100,000 D10, by the way. I feel like now we need to surface this bot to the general public.
I'm just going to
say
this now. It's written in Node.
Okay.
So in JavaScript. And so I would imagine it would work fine. As long as you were on a number that was less than 2 to the 53rd.
As the answer? As the output?
As the output, yeah.
Okay, Greg, solve that problem real quick.
So it would take like a die of 2 to the 52, and then adding things together probably wouldn't go to double it, but who knows.
I didn't get a response, so either your machine is still responding.
Oh, did you try to do a 2-carat?
No, I did roll. No, I did roll like 10 million D 10 million. Is your bot dead? Or is it just trying to do that?
No, it's...
Is it cranking along?
Let's see here. Oh, nope, it died. JavaScript heap out of memory.
Yeah, sweet.
Okay. That's curious to me that it did that. Maybe the random number generator croaked on that, because other than that, it should be iterative.
Wait, what random number generator? What are you using for random? Oh, you're using random for each die.
Yeah.
And then adding them together.
Yeah. So it should just be a sum going through, but I may have to take a look at that.
Yeah.
Because 10 million shouldn't have been enough to
Well, make it's recursive.
It shouldn't be recursive. It should be iterative.
Well, you have a recursive part in there in general for every die, don't you?
Why would I need a recursive? No. If you have a loop, you go, this is how many I have to do. So you have your loop.
Oh, so you're doing a for loop for the amount.
Well, I'm actually not, which is why I should probably change to it. I was using Lodash, the newer version of underscore library.
I wouldn't say Lodash is the newer version of underscore.
It is.
It's a different
It came out after underscore. It was made to be API compatible, and then they split off from there.
Okay.
It's a newer version of underscore.
Yeah, but
I didn't say it was better. I just said it was newer version.
But underscores continue to progress since the deviation, so they're both newer. It's a cousin. I win. Lyle wins.
No, it's
by the way, you had a spelling error today in your bot. Yeah. A spelling error.
Yeah.
So that's the second time.
Which you didn't catch. Greg caught it. just to be clear.
Dude.
You don't get any credit for that.
See you next week.
Yep.